the essential podcast for educators in the UK, made by teachers for teachers.
Hello and welcome to Homework Podcast. And today we are talking all things books, and we are delighted to say that we have got two brand new, brilliant, fantastic guests to join us.
Superlative.
And most importantly, brought breakfast actually, which is kind of the highlight of the week.
It's more than David's offered this week.
Yeah, I didn't even get a glass of water this morning. Anyway, thank you ever so much for joining us. Ladies, would you like to introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about yourselves, where you've come from and all that jazz?
Yes, I'm Vashti Hardy, author of Bright Storm and soon to be author of Wild Spark, out on the 2nd of May. And I'm a writer and I also work in digital marketing as well.
Very nice, thank you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for inviting me along. I'm Kate and I'm the librarian and also a teacher at Glebe Primary School in Southwick. And I'm very pleased to say that Vashti is our patron of reading at Glebe Primary School. And also a former pupil herself of Glebe Primary School.
Yeah, it was my old primary school, which was serendipitous, I think.
Totally.
So it worked out.
Yeah, really?
Look at that.
Yeah. That's so good.
That already breaking fresh ground this morning.
It was all meant to be.
Yeah. Destiny. So fantastic. I mean, thank you so much for joining us. And we kind of felt this morning what we'd do is kind of take a journey through children's literature, have a chat about a couple of...
Look at Ben painting a picture.
Dickensian. we go through this every week. Have a chat about children's literature, libraries and school, the future of libraries and school, all of that kind of stuff.
I hope there will be a future of libraries and school.
Well, that's it. And that's perhaps what we can discuss this morning. So just to kick off, I guess, gents, how do you think, what role do books play in your classrooms?
For me, I'm a little biased. I think there's nothing more important in primary schools than reading. I think the messages children can get from books, the vocabulary they can build from books, the adventures they can go on from books. So I think at that age where children are so impressionable, I think getting that love of reading amongst children is absolutely vital. So I think what role it plays in my classroom, I think I've tried really hard to create a culture where books are like the currency, where books are cool, where everything we talk about sort of comes back round to that, because I think it can have a really profound and long-lasting impact.
No, I completely agree. I think for me that we as teachers have an immense amount of responsibility to impart a love of reading to our children. I think that comes in many ways. It's us reading to them, it's us talking about new texts, also talking about sort of slightly more classical texts, to be able to share a love of reading. And I think for me, and I have to say David's been a big inspiration at our school, but I wasn't necessarily the keenest of readers as I grew up, and I think I put a tweet out there the other day, so I always found reading easy. I was very good at comprehension and things, but I didn't have a teacher that ever instilled a love of it. Now, and this is through speaking to Dave and other colleagues, I've developed a massive love for reading, and I think the best part of the day is when I read the book to the children. And I think it's imperative that we keep it up. It's really important.
Fantastic. And as a librarian and a teacher, I guess you've got to juggle both there. How do you feel? Have you seen it change over, say, 10 years or however long you've been teaching? Has it developed? How do you feel?
Definitely. I mean, I've been teaching for about 20 years, and I think I've seen a real move towards instilling reading for pleasure in the classroom. And it's just so lovely to see that. And I think sometimes as educators, we forget to give time to just reading for pleasure. We spend a lot of time picking books apart, getting children to analyse the text, looking at their funded adverbials and things like that. And we forget to actually let them enjoy a story. And just having time at the end of the day to read to your class and to just let them absorb that without discussing it even. Yep. Just let them listen to the story and leave your classroom at the end of the day buzzing with a book in their ears and going home and talking to their parents as they go out the door about what story they've heard.
Yeah.
That, I think, is the crucial, most important part of the day for me.
I think in education there's a bit of an obsession with proving impact, isn't there? X plus Y
Absolutely.
Equals Z, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Reading, we know it works. We know reading has a long-term sort of impact and can heavily benefit so many other areas. But I think, as you say, trying to sort of devote timetable time for reading for pleasure and just trust that the impact will be there is so, so important. And I think that is slowly coming back into schools, maybe.
It's very hard. I was just going to say, like, I used to teach in primary school, and I bumped into an ex-pupil the other day who just finished secondary school, and she, you know, forever you are the Mrs., aren't you? Mrs. Hardy, Mrs. Hardy in the middle of co-op. And she's like, I'm still reading, she said to me. And she was the child that didn't read in year six. She didn't pick up books. She was dyslexic, had a big wall up. And I started the year with a big project on using picture books and sort of dispelling the myth that picture books are just for young ones and using some good quality illustrated text like Wolves in the Walls. Mm. And through that, she was able to access books and use it as a springboard onto finding things that she loved. And she said to me, I was like, oh, so what did you read in secondary school? And she said, oh, I didn't read at all in secondary school. She said, the book, so I just went off it. She said, but I've just left school and I've really got into crime. Crime novel, not crime.
Oh, dear.
It's a crime.
And the prison has a wonderful library.
Actually, what we've done to cover ourselves in a homework podcast and not suggesting in any way, shape, or form.
I was a great teacher.
No.
Crime.
Truth comes out.
Crime fiction.
Crime novels.
Did you tell her that you're now writing?
Yes, so she knew I was writing and was really,
and she read your book.
Really excited. No, because it wasn't out when I'd seen her, but it was lovely for her the way she talked about all the books that we'd read in primary school was magical, and you know, I could see that little sparkle in her eyes that you get. You know, you see it as a teacher, don't you, when you're reading something to them, and they've got that look in their eye. You think you're there, and your imagination is on fire. I always say to children, when I'm doing author visits, that imagination is your superpower, and with reading, it's ripples in ponds, isn't it? It's hard to measure because you don't know. You can't tell necessarily that long-term impact that you're having by sort of letting them explore in their imaginations. And imagination is portable into all sorts of subject areas. They might not go on to be, you know, to work in anything to do with books or publishing or words or English, but they maybe that the use of that imagination might go into something scientific that they're doing,
100%.
Or dance, or maths, or engineering, or anything.
And it's those role models that crop up in books, like in Brightstorm, the showing that females can do certain things, or be certain, you know, take on certain characteristics, and don't have to fit stereotypes. And I think, as much as the wonderful wordplay and the wonderful like imagery created through books, it's just showing children that there is more to the world than what they see in their sort of day-to-day bubble, and books can take you there.
So there's, I'm going to ask, because I think it's worth saying, I've already read Wild Spark, and you just touched on there about kind of people, role models, etc. So obviously in Bright Spark, the majority of the central characters Bright Spark.
Ben's giving away a later title.
It's inevitable. I do it all the time.
there you go, I've given you a new name. A lot of the central characters are female. And obviously in Brightstorm, perhaps the most significant characters are female. Now, was that a conscious choice?
Yes, it was. Because when you're writing and creating a fantasy world, you're in a really unique position, I think. You get to choose the rules or the things in our world that are problems that you want to maybe keep and use as part of your story, and you get to choose what you might change and make differently if you want to. So for me, I thought, with both Brightstorm and Wildspark, I thought, well, what if the worlds in which my characters are going to be living, what if gender had never been a barrier to achievement? What if that it just had never been an issue in any way, shape, or form? So the cast of characters that you see in both Brightstorm and Wildspark hopefully show a good balance of female and male characters, maybe slightly more sort of female biased, but in a way I think you have to be a little bit sort of aware of that just to redress the balance slightly.
Do you feel there's a responsibility there as an author too?
Yeah, I do definitely. For me, because it's something that I feel really strongly about, and when I was young, when I was choosing my A-levels, I loved physics, loved maths and science. I liked all subjects. I was a very, like, jack-of-all-trades kind of person. And so I chose to do physics because I had a teacher who was championing me doing physics. And he said, yeah, do it for A-level, you'll be really good. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, maybe I can do this. Then turned up for the first day of A-levels, and he wasn't there. He'd got a job in Dubai. And I was like, oh. So I had a teacher that was a bit dry and cardboardish and sort of a room full of boys. I was the only girl, and I just thought, oh no, what am I doing here? What's going on? And I'd lost that champion voice telling me that I could do it. And I think it's easy when you're young to lose your nerve a bit and to.
Did you stick at it? Or?
No, I didn't. I switched to geography, art, and history of art, but
which were perhaps more female.
Which part of me thinks. I'm a bit annoyed at myself because I am quite tenacious and usually I don't let things like that get in my way. But then I was, you know, 15, 16. And also, the way my life's gone, I don't have any regrets because now I get to do it probably in a much more effective way. Yeah, I get to sort of champion these.
But it just goes to show what an impact a teacher can have, though.
Yeah.
You were there because you've been persuaded by the teacher, by the person.
Absolutely, yeah. Just one, which is like, you know, my responsibility as a writer, yours as teachers. Mm. Like, we all every day make these decisions, and it's the small things that you say to children and the small messages that you send in the fabric of the world that.
Even you've got. It's hinted at, I don't think you explicitly say it, but in Brightstorm, obviously, you have a gay relationship with the two kings.
Mm.
That, I mean, I don't think you explicitly say that, but it's very much suggested, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, I don't know whether you feel in terms of children's literature over the last 10 years or so, there's been far more kind of push towards acceptance, I think, of different, for example, like Sky Chasers, you've got an orphaned non-white female lead.
I just think it's so important for children to be able to see themselves, their friends, their families reflected in what they're reading, and for it not to be labelled or for it to define the story or what they're reading, but just to see the world around them reflected in what they're reading.
Yeah, because that's what the world is like.
Yeah.
I think there's a massive role of teachers, librarians, like reading role models, to show children that just because a book has a certain type of character or is a certain type of genre, that doesn't mean it's for a certain type of reader. Now, Brightstorm is a book that would be pretty instantly gender neutral, in the sense like boys and girls, I think, could happily pick that up looking at the cover, looking at the blurb. But there are books, like a book in my class recently, like the Alicia Dixon books, like I think it's amazing to see like boys naturally going for and picking that up now, and I've put a little bit of work into trying to show that this is a book that doesn't naturally have to just be read by girls because it's got a pink sprayed edge and a female protagonist. And I think there are books now that are sort of containing those themes, role models, characters, but that are, you know, appealing to all sorts. And I think that's really valuable, looking at like children getting that widespread perspective on life and the world around them going forward.
I think for us as teachers, the responsibility we have is to sort of dispel this myth that, oh, that's a book for boys, and that's a book for girls. And
absolutely.
I think you're right, in classrooms, I'm sure in libraries, and as an author, like, it is something we are consciously doing all the time and trying to break down those stereotypes that, no, you can't read that because that's just for girls. And you're right, that moment where you see a boy pick up a book that's maybe a traditionally a girl's book or vice versa is quite a special moment, I think.
Do you see that in terms of a library setting? I mean, do the children in your library have free kind of reign over what they choose, and are you seeing a change in those habits?
They totally do have a free choice about what they want to pick up and about what they want to read, and I think the teachers themselves are beginning to be good role models for the books that they're choosing to read to their classes. You know, just making those informed choices about making sure that they're not just sticking to well-known celebrity authors that they're reading out to their classes, that they're picking new authors, different authors, different genres of books, new books, and the more traditional older books as well. You know, the more traditional texts that you would expect to find in the classroom and on the shelves. And I think having a real mix of books is the right way to go about it, not just focusing on sort of one or two niche things.
But I think we've discussed it lots, and I think that one of the biggest things that perhaps is a hurdle or a barrier, if you like, is teachers themselves knowing books. I know a lot of the work that kind of Teresa Kremin's done at the Open University, etc. And I think one of the big things that teachers report is simply time.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, how do you, I mean, we certainly, I can speak for myself and David, not so much Sam, I don't think, in terms of like forcing the time to read these children's books to the same extent. I think it is about how you prioritise it. I mean, I don't know how you find that as well with teaching and having to be a librarian. I mean, there's plenty of people that just would say they don't have the time to read.
I struggle myself. My to be read pile is massive, it's taller than me. And it's, you know, where do you start with it as well? But it's about, you know, reading up. You know, you don't have to have read every single book cover to cover. You can read about it. Using Twitter is a brilliant way of connecting authors and teachers and librarians together to talk about books, and it's a great tool for being able to say, oh, you know, I've got a child who's really interested in such and such and I don't know quite what to recommend to them, what would you suggest? And someone else might chip in and say, well, I've read this and this is brilliant, try this. And so you don't feel that you have to have read everything. You can actually go to someone else for advice, and that's what's so great about sharing on Twitter. I think, you know, I have that concern that for all those teachers and librarians out there who are not using Twitter and are not kind of part of that community, how do they cope? How do they manage? How do we spread this love of books and our passion for reading for pleasure further without, you know, having it all online? What do we do about that? That's, you know, that's
definitely
an interesting question.
A really important question. I think the other thing that I certainly get comments that I'm perhaps very biased towards like modern children's literature. I'm sure others do the same, and obviously on Twitter it's very trendy, is like talking about modern children's literature. But I think that those messages that are coming through modern literature are perhaps like even more poignant than ever and even more important to convey to children. I was just going to give a little read of a first page. I took a picture of a book I read recently, which was it's not out yet, it's called A Dragon in the Library by Louis Stoll. I just took a picture of this page because I thought this goes straight in so well. So it's page one. Do you seriously want to spend the first day of the summer holidays with a bunch of dead people? Josh asked. He was a tall, skinny boy with brown skin, a broad nose and tight curls. If you had one word to describe him, he'd be very disappointed in you, because Josh believed that a wide vocabulary was very important. They're buried, Kit said. It's not like they're zombies. It's just a cemetery, and it's so overgrown that it's basically a park. Kit was a stocky, pale and red-haired girl with short hair. So I just think straight away these books are addressing themes of, you know, mixed race main characters, the type of different, you know, different hair textures that people from different backgrounds might have, female characters with short hair, you know, certain coloured hair. And I think you do it brilliantly with Arthur in Brightstorm, Arthur with his disability. And I just think it's like, it's so, so important that those messages are getting through to children. I think the subtlety in which it is being done nowadays is really, really clever.
And I'd agree. I think we're in a golden era of children's literature. I don't know what you think, Bashti. I think the last 10 years, perhaps even less than that, 5 or 6 years, it just seems to be book after book after book.
When we were growing up, you know, there weren't that many books to choose from.
No.
You know, now you walk into a bookshop and it's almost overwhelming, the choice that there is, and it's fantastic. I mean, we can't complain about having so many amazing books to choose from, and you know, the beautiful picture books that we have as well, beautifully illustrated picture books that we have too. And not just for younger readers, but for older readers as well, as you were saying.
Yeah, I think the quality is amazing at the moment. Really,
it's amazing that physical copies of books are so like prevalent nowadays, and still, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we'd have thought like Kindles were just going to take over, and I'm sure statistics suggest that Kindle readers are very
experience,
popular.
Isn't it?
Actually, having
being
a book,
holding a book is just. You
as my 13-year-old would say, I love the smell of a fresh book.
Yeah, no, it's true, and like the textures, are, like even here, the sort of
the
brushing.
But that's part of what I'm talking about with the last 5 years. Is that it? Even just seems that like book design has sort of. I mean, there's children in my class now that want to design book covers as a career. That's where they see themselves being. And it's partly down to book covers like yours. That, I mean, even I was saying, I even like this. I think this is
the proof cover.
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think I'm really lucky with Scholastic in that their designer, their Jamie Gregory, who works on my covers, has got such an amazing eye for what works, what reflects the story well.
And do you have much input on that?
No. No, I don't, but I could probably they always send me things at different stages and be like, oh, what do you think? And I've always gone back and went, yes, it's amazing, I love it. Like, you know,
no map in Wild Spark though.
Oh no, there is in the finished. I'm sorry, I only got sent two copies.
Oh, that's lovely.
But there is a map.
That's your geography A level coming through.
You said you love drawing maps.
It is. It's kind of like writing books. I told you I was a jack of all trades. Everything going. All my passions go into my books for everything. Geography,
I saw on your website that you mentioned that you often look at images whilst you're writing. I guess inspiration. When you're saying that now, obviously that Scholastic, for example, they have a lot of power when it comes to how your book eventually looks. Mm. Is it something you feel uncomfortable about, or you very much trust them to do the right thing?
I trust them wholeheartedly because they're experts in what they do. You know, I do my part of the job. My job is to write the best story I can possibly write, along with my fabulous editor, Linus, at Scholastic, who is a genius. Nice. so that's my part of the job, and then I think it's good for children to know that a team is involved in writing, because they can feel, oh, I'm not a good writer because I'm not great at one particular part of it, but actually there are so many people that make up the team that puts a book together.
In fact, on World Book Day at Glebe,
we
undertook the incredible task of organising all 502 children into making a picture book in a day.
Oh wow, that's amazing.
And Vashti kind of led our activities for the day, really, didn't you, and sort of explained how we were going to do it. Yeah, who was involved in putting a book together, the people behind the scenes, and we assigned different roles to different children.
Right, so they didn't all do a page, they all had a different sector of the book to work
on. We did it in various ways, didn't we? So we sort of we broke it down into the stages of that sort of you go through as well as we could of putting a book together, and then split off into subtasks. So they all had an initial input, maybe into coming up with character ideas. Then we had a core team chosen across the year groups, the core publishing team, who made decisions on, okay, we're going to choose, all the classes would feed back what they'd come up with, and then the core team would choose what they thought were the best two characters to take forward to the next level, or then the best synopsis that we were going to drive forward, and then that would get fed back to the classes, and then we'd do the next stage. It was
a kind of rolling process, wasn't it? We had different time deadlines during the day, which we had to try and stick to, real sort of publishing world of, you know, if you don't get it in by 10:15,
it's not making the cut.
Submission team says that's it.
Yeah. So we've touched on a couple of things there. So it's firstly sort of patron of reading, and secondly we were sort of mentioning about libraries, etc., and kind of their role within schools. Now, kind of with budgeting the way that it is, and with kind of finances the way they are in schools, how do you kind of feel? I know that, for example, a lot of schools are moving books from their library into classrooms and then closing the libraries, or they don't have a librarian, or it's a parent, or where do you both kind of envisage libraries and things like patrons of reading? Because I think a lot of schools we would love to have a patron of reading, but I think kind of finances come into it and all that kind of stuff, and how do you kind of see budgeting affecting reading and books in schools in the next 5 years?
Well, I think just starting with that patron of reading question, it doesn't have to cost a school a lot of money at all. Obviously we pay for author visits into schools, but those paid visits are financed not from the main school budget, but by fundraising.
Okay.
So, I might go to the PTA and ask for some funding to pay for a visit, or we might do a book sale. We've had parents donate secondhand books, and then we've sold those at a book sale after school to raise some money. Or we might, if a whole year group, the whole school is involved, ask parents to donate £1 or £2 each, which soon mounts up when you've got 500 children to pay for a visit. So it doesn't have to be an insurmountable task in the sense you say, we haven't got the budget to pay for an author visit. There are ways of doing it if you're clever and you think about it and you just plan ahead a little bit. I think having a patron of reading in school is an enormous benefit for the children to see the role model behind the book, to see that there is a person behind that process, that these things don't just appear by magic on the shelves, that there is a person, a normal person behind the books.
It makes it achievable, doesn't it? It shows you, as you say, authors are real people, when children are sitting in their lessons writing. they can envisage an author not just holding the finished article, but going through that process themselves, showing that they could actually become that in the way that they can see other careers. It just brings it to life.
Absolutely, and what that task did in making the picture book was show children that it is actually achievable. They could actually write a book, because by the end of that day, we had produced a picture book. All 500 children had been involved in making a book. We had done it. And, you know, whatever small role they had to play in that, whether it was coming up with a character idea, whether it was one of their illustrations that had gone into it, they were part of that, and they've seen it is possible. And off the back of that, the impact of that was we had so many children go away from that day and write their own book at home and bring it back in to us and show us. Or even, you know, they were just illustrating a comic or whatever it was that they chose to do off the back of that. It inspired them to create a book, to go away and think about reading, writing and drawing. And so that is the very sort of simple impact, if you like, of having an author into school, whether it's a one-off, a patron of reading, working with them longer term, developing a part of the curriculum, whatever that role is, it's so beneficial.
I think we always in schools talk about the importance of role models, and I think everything you're saying sounds fantastic, and just the way that obviously you as a child went to.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think if I was a child in your school and I knew that someone who used to come here has now transformed their life and become a really successful author, like that would do wonders for me. That would inspire me, and I think it breaks that scene of thinking, oh, I don't know anyone that's that. How do you become
I think we're incredibly lucky that you did go to Glee, and it was just really fortuitous.
Yeah.
We hadn't kind of realised when I asked you if you wanted to be our patient.
Oh, really?
We didn't know. And you know, I don't know how many other schools out there have a patron of reading who actually went to their school.
It's really cool. Yeah.
If you do have one, do let us know.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I went to Glee, you know, we had one of our teachers there. She'd read all the Roald Dahl books and she was a punk teacher. She had spiky red hair. She was quite scary.
Scary.
Yes. I was very young. She would do brilliant voices for the characters and things. And it just, every year group in primary, story time was a part of our day. I don't remember until secondary school when it all goes a bit strange. But yeah, primary school, you know, reading, story and imagination, where we had a lot of free time for doing.
And you've touched on it twice now, actually. The almost the hurdle of transferring that love of reading from primary school into secondary school. And I think if you were to talk to a lot of kind of teenagers now, they'd perhaps say that they loved reading as a kid, but they've got mobile phones and they've got friends to hang out with, and they've got. And I think perhaps one challenge that perhaps affects secondary teachers even more so is maintaining that love of reading once you kind of get into adolescence. I think like that young lady that you were discussing, and that I do think is a challenge, because I think that it's very hard. Perhaps you've almost got a captive audience to a point when they're this kind of age.
As a teacher, you have your class in primary school all the time, don't you? So if you can take that onus to really sort of embed a reading culture. Whereas as secondary school, it is just by its very nature, the children aren't with one person the total part of the day.
Yeah, you see them for
the teachers that teach so many different subjects, don't they? Is it realistic to have a physics teacher at secondary school trying to convey the love of literature? It seems really tough, which is a shame.
And an English teacher at secondary school has the entire English curriculum to deliver.
Exactly.
And perhaps with us, we're fortunate that we've got.
I think it's something to nail down at primary and hope that there's a.
I think we as well. Go ahead. Sorry, just to touch on that, as a primary teacher, I think some of the best moments are those sort of off the cuff 10 minutes where, do you know what, you just stop the lesson, you get your class book out, and the children are just in awe of what you're saying. And in secondary school, I'm sure just not possible.
No.
So I think that's something that we take.
And I think, if we flip it around, I think there is still a fear in some sectors of primary teaching of being able to do that. So for example, the age old kind of, we read for the last 10 minutes of every day, but the problem with that is that when things get tight on time, that's what falls off the end. I mean, I started reading with my class at the start of this year, purely through a book that I read that said, when was the last time your class actually saw you read? And I know that a lot of my colleagues or teachers in other schools would be a little bit worried about their head teacher coming in and seeing you just sat in the front of the class, not reading to the children, just reading.
I think it's so justifiable, though. Like, if you have someone come in and question you on that, I think as a teacher, you've got to be able to articulate the reasons why you're doing it, because the reasons why you're doing it are so far stretching that I think you
children
certainly
need to see you reading. They need to see you as a good reading role model. And in our school, we have posters for each teacher, each member of staff, actually, not just the teachers, to show what they're reading.
It's
and
cool.
They stick it on their door and above their desk to say, you know, Mrs. So-and-so is reading. Even the head teacher has this on her office door. And the office staff do as well.
It's getting that whole school culture.
So what would you say, playing devil's advocate, you have a new member of staff that joins that says they're not really a reader.
Well, we'd say, why are you in the school? No, but we are a reading school and we encourage that love of reading and we would want all of our staff to be involved in that. And if someone comes to us and says, well, you know, I'm not really sure how to engage in this, then that's one of my roles in the school as the librarian, is to infuse them about reading and try and change that.
Yeah. So how do you feel, so for example, we don't have a librarian at our school. What do you feel a librarian offers that's perhaps different to a teacher?
I think what I can bring to it is just a knowledge of children's books and how to use those children's books and kind of gluing it all together. Mm-hmm. So, yes, as we were saying before, teachers don't really have the time to kind of unpick what they could use and how they could use it. And direct the children. So one of the things that I do is if a child comes to me and says, I really don't know what to read next, or I'm just stuck on all the David Walliams books, I don't know what to move on to next. And I can sort of take them and guide them and talk to them about what their interests are, about what sort of books they've read already, and put the right book in their hands. And that's something that teachers just don't have the time.
No, I agree.
The knowledge. Yeah.
And I think
is that a big workload issue for you outside of school, or do you get release time to do that, or do you know what I mean? Do you have
you
to
put in a lot of extra?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Well, is it that schools almost rely on goodwill of someone to step up?
It is, yeah. I mean, I do think, it is essential, if that's going to work, to have someone who has a passion for books, and I do have a passion for books, I always have done, who is willing to share that love and that passion for books. And I do, you're right, Vashti, I do put in a lot of extra time. I get paid to work 3 days a week.
Right.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah. I am very often there Thursdays and Fridays as well, and out of school hours. And yes, I'm on Twitter a lot as well, sort of sharing that passion, that knowledge. And I read a lot.
But you see that value in it, and you feel it.
Yeah. Well, totally. But then all teachers have things that they give as added value. They might run a sports club, or they might do a drama club, or whatever it is after school. My role in the school is books and reading, and that's the extra that I give. So
just thinking something else that you do that really impressed me when I visited was with
please tell.
I think it's that the championing you do of the school library service, the West Sussex School Library Service, which often doesn't get used. So I think a librarian can really pull the teachers together and sort of be like, what books do you need for these topics?
Yeah,
and sort of be the person that gets the books ordered and coming in and supports in that way the library service and keeps it going, because I think a lot of teachers would maybe not have the time or the knowledge or of what.
And we wouldn't manage to stock the library without West Sussex Library Service. They are amazing. And yes, as a school, we pay for that service. We have a contract. We need to pay for that. And I fought hard to make sure that we retain that contract, because if we lost that, we would lose our the majority of our book stock. But the library service are amazing. They can come in, they can help with an audit of books, they can come in and even help with the books in the classrooms, not just the books in the library. We have the library van visit twice a year, where the children can go with an armful of books in the classrooms to swap over their choices. And then they are responsible for those books. They take ownership of what they're reading, because they get to go and choose some more books to have in the classrooms.
When you say you like reading teachers at your school, what would the expectation, obviously it's not an exact number of books, but what are we saying for a teacher to be a sort of a teacher that reads? Because I think certainly Ben and myself, I'd say we read a lot of children's literature, probably far
as well.
Sam reads a lot as well, but I think we would probably read way more than your average teacher would realistically be expected to read to stay up to date.
I'd say Sam, you two go above and beyond the average.
So so it's trying to find that middle ground, and I guess that's where yourself, you'd definitely add value as a librarian, because there's only so many books you can actually read when you're balancing your day job. I guess teachers, you're talking about staying up to date with some current children's literature that perhaps fits your age bracket. It's hard, isn't it, to expect teachers to read 40-50 books a year. That's not perhaps a...
I think, you know, the key thing there is maybe sharing that book knowledge. So, you know, if teachers are reading, just making sure that you're discussing that in the staff room or at staff meetings, taking along the books that you've read and saying, well, I've read this, this is fantastic, I think this would work really well in your class or with your children. You know, because, you know, we're teaching different age groups as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to have that knowledge, especially when you're talking about year three and year four, where they, when that sort of crossover...
It's a grey area, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, they're, you know, kind of moving away from the shorter chapter books,
getting off colour bounce, isn't
it? Chapter books and, you know, the longer middle grade books, but some of them are not quite ready for that, and it's having that crossover knowledge. And I think it's just that process of, you know, we need to share our book knowledge, we need to share our love of reading a bit more.
And you do kind of have to have a good knowledge to know what those bridge sort of books are that are suitable for children that are coming off colour band books to chapter
3-4 is the most difficult age bracket excuse me, to write a book for. I think, like, we discussed, like, Riddles of the Runes, I think that is almost a perfect
example. I think those Amelia Fang books this year are very good.
Really, I think it's really hard. I mean, I don't know, Ashley, when you set out to write a book, do you think in your head, I'm going to specifically aim this at years 5, 6 and potentially 7 even with something like Wild Spark? Is it just you write what you want to write, and I'm driven by the story, the ideas
and the what ifs that I'm...
Do you want to tell us a little bit about Wild Spark? We haven't actually
Wild Spark comes from a big what if, really. I think most of my books come from just asking a big question. I mean, all us writers, we've just got inquisitive imaginations. And so Wild Spark, I was thinking, what if you could bring back ghosts and put them inside really lifelike animal robot type of machines? What would that world be like? What would the technology be? What would the issues be? What are the grey areas? It's a bit of a, you know, Jurassic Park question, isn't it? Just because you can doesn't mean you should, and like, which is an everlasting question for the modern world as well. With technology moving as fast as it is, the questions of, you know, what are the issues that fast advancing technology brings, and what are them? What's the moral grey area going on, and it just struck me as a really interesting, thought-provoking idea that gets my cogs whirring, so hopefully it will
That sounds really cool. I've got a writing-related question. So a few times here we have alluded to the idea of sort of encouraging children's reading so they can go on experiences or they can build images in their mind, and that helps their creativity. Now, certainly for Brightstorm, and I haven't read Wild Spark, but there are things that either you will have had to experience firsthand or you'll have experienced through books. So I'm talking about the types of terrain that people are travelling through, that sort of thing. Where are you getting those ideas from? You've talked about using perhaps like a rainforest in the future in one of your books. Have you been to the rainforest? Are you getting those ideas from books you've read? I'm just wondering how you as a writer are drawing on those experiences, because we certainly talk about doing the same for children in their writing when we're at school.
Yeah, so actually when I do my author talk, when I go into school and my workshops, that's a big part of sort of what I do, is going in and showing sort of how it all comes. I always say to the children as well, like, one of my slides is like, writing is not just about writing, which seems like a very strange thing to say, but by that, you know, part of my aim when I go into schools is showing them so much of what I do involves a different side from just putting the words on the page. There is map making and using pictures and music and doing research using factual books as well to build my words and bring it all together. So also I think it's really important for children that are maybe from a privileged background, who maybe don't get to travel much, that you can still access these things that you need to build your world. I mean, when I was growing up, we didn't have much money to go on holidays and things. I certainly didn't come from a family of explorers and adventurers that were going off to the rainforest or anything. So it's kind of, for me, you know, I did obviously get out in the, you know, there's a certain amount we can all do in our own environments and things that can be really adventurous and fun and to do with learning about being outside. But also, it's not, you know, there's a scene where Arthur falls into quicksand.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was writing that scene, and when I
tell children about this in schools. I show them the clip that I watched to write that
That's
scene
amazing.
Of yeah. Bear Grylls yeah. in quicksand, because yeah. when I was writing it, I thought, well, I can't really go and jump in quicksand.
It'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah. That would be a bit daft.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. Hell, stop! I'm in a situation
here. Am I insured for this? Yeah.
So I thought, you know, when I was writing it, I thought, okay, so how can I do this authentically and get it right? And I yeah. thought, oh, I know someone who will have done that. Of course, Bear Grylls will have done that. So went yeah. into the YouTube, Bear Grylls quicksand, and of course, Bear Grylls has done that. So I watched that yeah. and it just helps with the language and getting it right. And for ideas, I mean, I'm just like watching the new Bear Grylls that's just come on.
I think Piers Morgan's on one of them, isn't he?
Is it? I've not seen that one.
Get him in some quicksand.
I think that's very prudent. I think.
Yeah. So I think that's where children sort of seeing that there are different ways into writing adventure, fantasy worlds and world building. So I usually show them my Pinterest boards, mm-hmm. which, like the Brightstorm one, teachers can just go into Pinterest
cool.
yeah, and put in my name and Brightstorm and see all the pictures that I use.
Amazing.
To help me, and I'm doing, like, as I'm building the world for Brightstorm 2, I'm doing exactly the same, using lots of pictures. You know, my word count is very low for the story at the moment, because so much of what I'm doing is coming up with the ideas and working out, drawing maps. That's the first thing I do, is draw a map. So one of the workshops
That's
I do
cool.
in school is drawing fantasy maps, and it's a great way for children to... They don't even realise they're plotting out a story by drawing
really
a map,
good.
But yeah. you're I show them pictures of all the sort of dangers that they could include, from natural disasters to interesting animals that you might want to put on your map.
It's turning writing on its head as well a little bit, isn't it? And starting with the imagery.
Yeah, I think that's how Harry Potter started. I think she drew the characters first before she went on to even write.
And it's something we've been focusing on a lot at Glebe at school at the moment. In fact, all of our classes this year are named after illustrators. So
that's cool. That's nice.
It's been a fantastic thing to do, and it's meant that we've interacted
Raise
with
the
a lot
of
more
illustrators, yeah.
illustrators. We've got a patron of illustration as well. We've got
that's
the amazing
so
Stephen
cool.
Lenton on
board really?
As our patron of illustration at school, and he's been incredibly inspirational at getting the children to look at books through the pictures, not just the words, and it's opened up reading to a lot more children who perhaps would not have been, you know, very reluctant, very forthcoming in picking up a book, would have been more reluctant readers, and they're now looking at the books through pictures, they're looking at comics, graphic novels, and bringing, you know, reading to life through the pictures. It's been so valuable.
That's really refreshing, I think, certainly for us. We want our children to read more when we think about the notion of putting down the tablet and put all the technology away. But what you're saying is almost embracing that when it comes to writing, using what we have now at our disposal, and really use YouTube, use image searches to really inspire. Mm. That, for me, just listening to you, it's really exciting to hear that, because I think we think about, oh, put all that away, let's focus, but actually you're embracing it, which is really
interesting.
Yeah,
and I think, like I say, for the children that maybe
don't experience things, use YouTube.
We can all in the classroom, like, well, unless you've got YouTube blocked,
but
most of us can, you know, in the classroom you can go on and you can, you know, let's get some ideas, let's just watch, you know, some Bear Grylls or equivalent.
Yeah. I think what that shows as well, and it does contrast to how writing is often taught in schools, is the idea of like forming a piece of writing is quite a random process often, where you are drawing on lots of different ideas you have, getting what you've got down, you know, what is in your head on paper, and then layering
it. They need to, you know, they often don't have the context to write something because they haven't experienced it. And we expect them to be able to do that. So
especially,
we need to be able to give them the pictures or the opportunity to draw what's in their heads to help them form their writing.
And children are sponges, aren't they? So when we open them up to it.
But I think that's why especially why children find it hard when you say, right, you can write about whatever you want.
Why on earth would you want,
if I was 8 years old and was told, write about whatever you want, I would sit there for half an hour trying to think, oh, well, do I want to write about dinosaurs, or do I want to write about dragons, or maybe I could do a football team. Do you know,
some children would fly with that, and some it would freeze them completely, if you present them with lots of tools to choose from to support where their choices might go, then that's the kind of key to it. So when I do the map making with with classes. I talk about my journey with Bright Storm and where I get all my influences from, and my love of real life explorers and adventurers and different. I'll show them lots of pictures of different natural disasters and animals and things, and talk to them about their interests, what they could share, what they could make a world into, what big what if questions they might ask. And then all of a sudden, because there's the children that are really sharing their ideas, the people that maybe don't have any, I start to think, oh yeah, I could do that. Okay, all right, I might use those couple of pictures and see.
Yeah.
I like those. Let's see where that takes me.
There's some important messages, I think, coming from that, as well as what we spoke about earlier with just devoting time for reading for pleasure. And that's that things like you've just suggested don't have to purely take place in an author visit day. Mm. And that's that I think sometimes teachers are perhaps concerned that what they're doing in lessons is not going to show in books, and that if someone walks in, how are we going to prove that what we're doing is adding impact? And to produce wonderful writing does create, like, you know, sometimes that comes in lots of different ways and forms that doesn't necessarily show linear progress along the way, and it is just allowing children to embrace their ideas, their imagine, their creativity, and then see where that leads.
I tell you one thing you could do, which I do as a writer very often. So my time's quite stretched between, like, my day job in digital marketing and my writing time and my family. So one thing I do is on my lunch break, I'll put my headphones in, put my Spotify playlist on, which is all sorts of soundtracks, and I'll go for a walk around the park a few times and just listen to music. And the amount of times a little idea will come to me, or something in a scene or an emotion that will just all of a sudden. So that would be easy to translate into the classroom. Yeah. You could just, you know, with the whole class, just play some different
sort of stimulus.
Things like How to Train Your Dragon, a brilliant, the Harry Potter ones, the Narnia, all really atmospheric, and they take you, because film is storytelling, obviously.
Journey,
so that each soundtrack, there'll be it will reflect some sort of feeling or scene.
Sure.
So it's amazing how ideas can come through the music. Mm. So you could do that in class, just kind of like, just let them, allow them to sit and experience the music and see what comes.
Thinking time, isn't it?
Give them some little post-it notes to jot down things as they come.
So how are you finding still juggling two jobs?
Oh, it's hard.
Like,
it's hard.
I know lots of authors say it's very hard to make a living from being an author. Hard. Like, how do you find that? Two jobs at once.
It's tricky, it's full on. It is really full on, but also, I don't know, I love what I do, and it's important to me, so I do what I have to do. In an ideal world, I would just be focusing on my books.
And you printed at Bright Storm 2. Can you reveal anything that's an exclusive for Homework Podcast?
Yes, so. So Maudie has a new invention.
Oh, here we go.
Right,
David. I'm just taking notes.
Is David pleased about that?
Yeah. It's really, I don't think I can say too much about it, but it's really, really, really cool.
Are we talking 2020 release? Next year?
Yeah, so early sort of March-ish, depending.
Just ready for my birthday.
Yeah,
anyway, let's carry on.
Yeah, so we've just got a new invention, and we're going the very much sort of jungly rainforest sort of atmosphere, but with a big twist.
So are we still in the great wide, or can we not know?
Well, all I will say is, at the end of Bright Storm, there's a little hint to where it's all going. So at the end, it says that Hermitage Wrigglesworth has gone missing, a notable explorer has gone missing somewhere in the eastern.
Read Island. Into that as you will.
So there's this kind of Bright Storm 2 picks up on heading to the east.
Right. And will it be called Bright Storm 2, or are we expecting a fresh title?
It will probably be. My titles always change, so I don't say, but it will be something, probably something, a Bright Storm adventure.
Yeah,
nice.
I've got an idea. There's a kind of a sapient thing.
Yeah, I can, just for those listening, Rashti is squirming so much. She doesn't know what she can say. We're being a little bit harsh, I think.
Those things are okay.
I think Ben could be a police detective. teaching doesn't work out.
Okay, so one final question actually about Bright Storm and Wildspark. When do you envisage them being set? So my children, we're talking about, I know you've talked about the steampunk kind of. So obviously, like, you've got Lontown, etc., etc. So is this kind of like a parallel Earth? It's almost Victorian-esque. What were your kind of intentions? When do you sort of envisage their era?
Yeah, in my mind, it's a little bit, I suppose it's a bit in that Star Wars way, you know, that kind of a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It could be like a long time ago, it could be in an alternate universe, it could be like if technology in our world had gone a different way, if our Earth had maybe evolved slightly differently, if the countries had split apart differently. Yeah. So I see it as like a parallel type of our world with a what if things had gone a little bit differently to the way they are. But obviously it has that slight Victorian-ish feel to it in the naming. But I think that sort of is quite freeing to be able to mix technology, like modern, almost like with Wildspark, it's very advanced technology, but with a slightly old-fashioned feel, and that's quite, I don't know, to me it feels quite a magical place to be. I can see those worlds quite easily.
And it obviously captures the imagination. So, I mean, that's pretty much all the time we have, but I would just like to say one final question to both of you. One book that you can read to a class for the rest of your life.
Ooh. Oh,
I know. Choose one book.
Oh, shall I go first? What do you think?
I'm really upset.
Should we get Ben to answer his?
Like, everyone's going to think that I'm absolutely making this up, but I would say
Fanboy.
Yeah.
We now use it in my class. We've just finished it. I genuinely, there's lots and lots of books that I think are fantastic. Sky Chasers I thought was brilliant, and I could name many others, but I just think Bright Storm has it. For me as a child I think is true. I think it just, there's so much in it that I just love.
That's lovely. It's special to hear that, because at the end of the day, that's like my job as an author, is to ignite that little spark of love for reading into
that Bright Storm.
You know, that novel, Bright Spark.
Bright Spark. That's what they used to call
that.
Storm.
That's it, maybe
it should
have endless options.
Yeah.
There you go. Is it too late to change the title? what do we think? So, one book for the rest of your careers, if you were to have a class again, Vashti.
I'm going to go for
Bright Storm.
I'm going to go for Rebecca's World by Terry Nation, which is the book that sparked everything for me and people sort of my age. There's a little bit of a Rebecca's World club, because when we were at school, it was really it was just a bit revolutionary, I suppose, quite ahead of its time. And it was written by Terry Nation, who also created The Daleks in Doctor Who. It was his only children's book. It's just, Rebecca, she goes magically transported through space through a telescope, ends up on a planet. There's one tree left on this whole planet, so she kind of goes on a mission to find this tree, following a map. With riddles on. There's an unlikely group of friends that she makes in the way. You can kind of see where my little things are. But that book for me was the book that made me realise that imagination has no boundaries, and that I could go anywhere as a child in my mind, and it made me think I want to be a writer. And then I would read that book to my classes when I was a teacher, and see the little magic spark in their eyes. It's a bit timeless. You can't buy it anymore though.
It's out of print. I've not heard of it.
Out of print, but bide your time. Look on like the eBay channels and things, and occasionally you'll find one for about £10, but it goes for ridiculous money. But
really?
Bide your time and look for it, and you'll find it. And it's very good for year 3-4 actually.
Well, there you go.
And you can get the audiobook, funnily, but not the
Okay, I'm going to choose something a little bit different. So not in the sense of a classic book, because I think if you try and pin me down to a favourite book, children's book or otherwise, I would say it depends on the age of the children, who I'm reading it to, whether I'm reading it aloud or whatever. But I'm going to go for the kind of Oi Frog series, the picture books.
Okay,
I think they're incredible, and they've worked really well when I've read them to younger children, and even reading them to groups of year 6 children who are just falling about laughing at them as well. And they're just really lovely books, in that you have so much prediction in them as well. You can pause, and the children can come up with whatever the next word's going to be for the rhyming. I found them incredibly useful for teaching phonics as well, because of the phonics and all the rhyming in them. They're just such a useful series of books. books. And when you say to the children, there's another one coming out, hooray! And they get so excited about it. And they've just worked across the age ranges.
Really?
So
fantastic. I'm going to hop in here because I feel
a
bit left out.
Sam, you can have one as well.
I won't be the first to say this, but Who Let the Gods Out series, Maz Evans.
Yeah.
I just think very popular books, but just have a little bit of everything. I think aesthetically, the books are absolutely stunning. I think the fact that there's a four-book series is amazing.
It's rare today as well.
It is. I think the fact that... I think the books can travel with children through Key Stage 2, so I've done Who Let the Gods Out with Year 4, which I think as a class read works well. I think it would take a more capable year, more experienced Year 4 reader as a sort of solo read, but I think they can get that taste, and I think they can sort of take those books with them through their sort of primary school years. I think it addresses some really heavy, serious themes in a clever and quite subtle way. So you've got like themes of dementia, you've got themes of loss, you've got friendships, all sorts of different things there. I think you've got characters from every walk of life in quite a humorous sort of godlike form. And I just think for me, whilst there's so much brilliant children's literature, it wouldn't be that that's my favourite book, but I think that's a brilliant book to get children going on their sort of
Key Stage 2
read.
And to get them hooked into a series of books as well. I think brilliant.
Sam? I was going to say the same thing, but I won't. And I will just say, I read that book before David.
He did.
Come on. He's,
and you realise, I led David the second one.
I've got it on my shelf upstairs. It's upstairs.
So
I then have to go and buy it the second one.
So a book called Kick by Mitch Johnson. So for me, I think I read this year to my class. It just opened up the children's eyes to how different life could be if you were born into a family in a different country, and the way that the main character works in a factory making football boots, and the way that that to the children is just so alien. Yeah, they couldn't imagine that to even happen. And I think then you have all the other sort of social side of it, where the housing is just nothing like they're used to, the fact that there's natural disasters, there's all sorts of go on that we just don't experience here. For me, it was a really eye-opening book.
Fantastic. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us.
We've got pastries to eat.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting us.
Welcome anytime.
I think we could probably chat all day.
Yes, well, that's it. But no, thank you so much for your time, genuinely.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
For much more content exclusively for teachers by teachers, visit homeworkmagazine.co.uk. Also, please follow us on social media at homework_magazine and at homework_podcast. Homework Podcast is brought to you by Iguanas Producciones.